Pre-dead life, pre-dead life.
Dead Boys. It's the award-winning podcast about the history and culture of death and decomposition. My name is Dorian. With me as always is Max. Max, we're 40. This is episode 40.
Oh.
We're over the hill now.
No, I'm not.
You're 40 now. I'm 40. We're both 40. That's how that works, right? It's podcast years.
That's why you don't do weekly. It ages you very quick.
Yeah, that's why we do bi-weekly. So we stay pre-dead forever. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. Had some pizza for dinner.
You did.
That was good. You watched me eat it.
Yeah.
Shovel it into my maw.
I wanted it.
Sorry.
No, that's
you
okay.
You texted me. I would have gotten you some.
Oh, if I would have known. That's all right.
It's a spooky month. I like that. You have any spooky takes or opinions you want to voice up top?
Spooky stuff is good. That's, 30 years running of my life. Spooky stuff has always been good. And this year I'm getting into Twin Peaks. I'm finally watching the entire series.
Taking the plunge.
Yeah. I never made it past the first season because I have a short attention span for TV shows. And I think Game of Thrones new season came out when I tried to watch it. Yeah. And I was like getting distracted.
Yeah.
But I am determined this year, if not October, this year, I will have watched all of Twin Peaks, including the movie, including the return.
Good.
I want to watch all of it.
The movie is very intense. I saw it in a theater recently, and they had like Ray Wise and Cheryl Lee, who play Leland Palmer and Laura Palmer, come in.
Yeah.
It was dope. It was very cool.
Oh, man. I'm jealous of that.
Yeah.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
What are you getting into this spooky season?
I have been visited by a ghost, actually.
What?
So sometimes the thing that pisses me off about the fact that we hang out before we record this podcast is that, like, I have something that I want to tell you. But it's funny, so I want to save it for the episode.
Oh, shit.
I've been visited by a ghost.
I couldn't tell if this was some kind of bit that you were doing before the episode, but
no.
you had a paranormal experience.
The past few days, I was visited by a ghost. Do you know what ghost it was?
What ghost?
It was the ghost of the asparagus that I've been eating for, like, lunch and dinner the past 3 days.
God damn it, Max. That's it? This was a bit.
It's a stinky...
Yes, a stinky ghost. I get it. I see what you did there.
We take a bathroom break before we start each episode. And I specifically made sure that you went first so that you would detect that I had asparagus pee and that I could make that joke without you. It's the dumbest thing I've ever done.
Wow.
Oh, boy.
Well.
Wow.
May you be purged of this ghost soon. And good job. Good job. You got me on that goof. I got all excited that you saw an actual ghost. Damn.
I upset one of my coworkers, which is very funny. So, what we are doing is peaking the mic by me clapping. And also rebooting our previous October episodes.
Yes.
Because we're taking a look at the intersection of death and monsters and Halloween stuff. Just stuff we wouldn't really cover normally.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of lines up with the October deal we've got going on. So last year we did zombies and we did vampires.
Yes, we did. It was fun episodes.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it's funny that both were undead focused. So I figured that what we could do is stick with what works and go to one of the OG undead / resurrection horror stories, Frankenstein.
Yes.
So let's strap in multiple times to one of those big swinging tables.
Yeah.
And get ready for the episode with the pre-Dead Boys crack into the topic moment brought to you today by a very special guest.
A special seltzer.
A special seltzer. The only seltzer that has ever caused me to have a conversation with both the cashier, the person behind me in line at the market, and the person in front of me. Four people came together to have a conversation about the seltzer I was buying.
LaCroix Hibiscus.
It's a new LaCroix flavor and a new look can.
Wow.
It's got a little flower on there.
It's beautiful.
It's not hibiscus. Hibiscus.
There's a dash. There's a hyphen.
But I was, because our, the place where I got pizza from has like just a Lucy seltzer can wall.
Yep.
And these were like sitting in there and I was like, well, I don't know what that is. So I grabbed them and I had them on the belt. And I was checking out, and the person behind me, like, was like, oh, that looks like a new LaCroix flavor. What is that? And I was like, you know, I don't really know, but I'm excited to try it. And the cashier was like, it looks like it's hibiscus, but I've heard good things about it. And then the person in front of me, bagging her groceries, was like, yeah, they're doing, like, cola now or something.
So they don't even know that we do a podcast where this is a whole shtick that we have.
No, I couldn't bring myself to.
They just sense that you were an expert on seltzer.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we definitely need to crack in and give a little review of this.
This little pre-Dead Boys crack on the topic moment brought to you by LaCroix Hibiscus. Easy crack on this one.
Fruity.
Interesting.
Floral. Fun. I love it.
I was going to get you the Simple Truth pineapple stuff. Got you this instead, and I'm pretty happy. It tastes like when people who don't like LaCroix like the key lime flavor of LaCroix, because it tastes a little wetter, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This reminds me of key lime. It's like wet. It's got a mouthfeel to it.
Yeah, I'm a fan. Good on LaCroix. Coming up out of the ditch.
Of like business. Saying bonkers shit on about everything, I think.
Yeah, and their press conferences. Good on them for creating a new product. We stand.
For doing their job.
All right, so Frankenstein.
Frankenstein. Were you reading Frankenstein or Dracula?
Read some Dracula. Have not read Frankenstein, sadly.
I forgot which book you were trying to slog through.
Oh, right now it's Moby Dick.
Oh, I forgot you're on the Moby Dick tip.
Yeah, except I'm mostly on the playing Nintendo Switch instead tip. So.
So, just full disclosure, I can't stand either Dracula or Frankenstein. I just don't like Victorian writing.
Oh.
I do not groove with it.
Okay.
But I think it's a really interesting book when you kind of consider it in context before we start slamming it because of the writing style. Kind of like actually what our next little pre-dead media corner is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people might hate it, but in context, it's very cool and important.
Yeah, stay tuned for that special spooky season treat next week.
Yeah. So, Frankenstein is interesting because it was at the forefront of a lot of the social change and economic change and everything change that was happening in England at the time. And Mary Shelley, who wrote the book, along with like everyone else in the country, was trying to grapple with how to exist in a world that was starting the process of industrialization and transformation. It was a weird time to be alive because it was the first time society really accelerated in a pretty rapid way.
Okay.
Art exists to be like a metaphor for how we feel that allows us to detach a little bit.
Right.
And I think Frankenstein is Mary Shelley's way of detaching and dealing with how she felt about, like, science.
Yeah. You know?
So for folks who aren't aware of the story, I did want to give a quick summary that I'm going to read.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, taking my job from
me. Well, because you have to read some shit later.
Cool.
So Victor Frankenstein is a scientist, not a doctor.
Oh.
Interestingly enough, you always hear, like, Dr. Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Not a doctor. He is never given the title Doctor in the book.
So all of those pretentious people were like, the monster is not called Frankenstein. He is Dr. Frankenstein's monster.
You just one up him, yeah.
You can just come right back and be like, actually, wasn't a doctor.
He just had a master's.
Also, don't tell me the way that I should like things. Let me like them my own way.
Shorthand to things, and like the movies were all like Bride of Frankenstein was about Bride of Frankenstein was about a bride being made for the monster, and like young, I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
It's the whole thing.
We're not there yet.
So Victor Frankenstein is a scientist who's experimenting with life and electricity, and he kind of cobbles together a creature that is actually made out of materials that are unnamed in the book.
Hmm.
So, you know, the Bela Lugosi movie has just a bunch of sawed-off body parts and stuff like that.
You mean the Boris Karloff.
Boris Karloff movie, there we go.
Yeah, yeah.
The Boris Karloff movie has... Oh, I'll let you correct me. You know, I'll leave that in. The Boris Karloff movie makes it seem like he's like an amalgamation of different like plug-and-play body parts.
Right.
Not how it was. Unnamed in the book.
Hmm.
He uses electricity to put life into it. Similar to the big, like, you know, standing on top of the tower, lightning storm scene that's really famous.
Right.
But Victor Frankenstein is disgusted by his creation. And his creation kind of has a bunch of different names. He's never specifically named, but he's referred to as like the abomination, the monster, the being, the fiend. Just not a lot. The ghoul.
Not flattering.
Not flattering.
He's very rude to this poor new man.
So we're going to go with monster, because that's kind of what's the common parlance is.
Sure.
But understandably, like you said, the monster feels like Victor Frankenstein is kind of being a huge dick.
Yes.
And the monster kind of has this childlike naivete, wants to be loved and cared for. And Victor Frankenstein is just like, no, I don't like this. So, like, Frankenstein distances himself from the monster. He doesn't give it a name. He rejects it. He flees from it. And then the monster makes some not great decisions about how to get close to its creator by, like, killing his brother.
Well, I don't know, Max. How do you make friends?
So, the monster, like, kills Frankenstein's brother and then frames his sister for it. So the sister is also executed.
Yeah.
So, like, oops.
Hey, they didn't have Bumble back then, so how do you meet new people, honestly?
So, and, like, eventually it ends up with, like, the monster learning language and being very eloquent and kind of being able to put his desires into words. And he has a conversation with Frankenstein and he's like, hey, create a companion for me, and then me and my wife will just go to South America, and we'll leave everybody alone. Like, that's the plan. Like, the monster's like, you make me a wife, and I'll go to South America.
So he's like a lot of old Midwestern people. It's just, I just want to get married and move south.
He's a snowbird. And Frankenstein creates a wife, and then is like, oh, I did this before, and destroys it, and that just makes the monster even more upset.
Why does he destroy the wife? He's just still so taken aback by what he's done and creating this monstrosity.
Yeah.
He created two monstrosities.
And he learned from the second one.
Okay.
Yeah. And that causes the monster to decide to spend the rest of its life exacting revenge on Frankenstein, and causes Frankenstein to spend the rest of his life trying to hunt down and kill the monster. So kind of similar to Moby Dick, actually.
Okay.
But it kind of plays with a lot of themes of how, like, regret versus remorse. So, like, Frankenstein regrets creating the monster, but he's not actually remorseful about it, because he's only just sad about, like, the bad things that are happening to him. He never feels sympathy for the monster.
Hmm.
It deals a lot with, like, masks that we put on in interacting with other people, because Victor Frankenstein, like, wants to create something good, but can't communicate to the monster that he wants the monster to be good. And the monster is very eloquent and caring and really cares for his, like, quote-unquote father, but is too busy, like, killing everyone that Victor Frankenstein loves to communicate that. So, It's got a lot of mask stuff, which is neat.
Interesting.
But before we kind of talk about who Mary Shelley was and how her biography informs the writing of Frankenstein, I wanted to highlight a quote by Victor Frankenstein in the novel that I think serves as a really good backdrop for Shelley's life and the book as a whole. So this happens as Frankenstein is chasing the monster down after the monster murdered Frankenstein's wife, Elizabeth. This is Frankenstein and Elizabeth's wedding night. The monster is pissed that Frankenstein destroyed the monster's wife. And so he intends to destroy Victor's wife, and he ends up killing her on their wedding night.
So he's robbing Victor Frankenstein's joy from him because he couldn't experience that joy himself.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So here's a quote that Victor Frankenstein says that I think is really informing kind of what we want to look at as we're going through the rest of this episode.
I threw down the oar, and leaning my head upon my hands, gave way to every gloomy idea that arose. If I looked up, I saw scenes which were familiar to me in my happier time, and which I had contemplated but the day before, in the company of her who was now but a shadow and a recollection. Tears streamed from my eyes. The rain had ceased for a moment, and I saw the fish play in the waters as they had done a few hours before. They had then been observed by Elizabeth. Nothing is so painful to the human mind as a great and sudden change. The sun might shine or the clouds might lower, but nothing could appear to me as it had done the day before. A fiend had snatched from me every hope of future happiness. No creature had ever been so miserable as I was. So frightful an event is single in the history of man.
Yeah, I think in particular that line, nothing is so painful to the human mind as a great and sudden change, is really well written.
Yeah.
And I think that's Mary Shelley using the character of Victor Frankenstein as a mask for her and England's disenfranchisement with, like, the Industrial Revolution, technological development, medical development, things like that. Mary Shelley was a romantic, so she was, like, really into big grand ideals of love and open fields and pastoral scenes, like, very Thoreau, you know?
Okay.
And it makes sense that she wouldn't be a big fan of, like, industrialization and science and technology, even as we look at them and understand them in, like, an early 1800s period, you know?
Was the general public response to the Industrial Revolution, do you think it was, like, optimism and, like, oh, here we go, like, society is just heading in a good direction? Like, that was the popular opinion, was that all of these big changes were objectively good? Or do you think that skepticism that Shelley had, was that shared with the average person?
I think it was shared with a lot of folks. Like, okay. It did create a middle class to a degree, but it also meant that people were working 6 days a week in factories, and that pollution skyrocketed, you know? Things like, you know, medical science were moving in directions that a lot of people felt weird about based on the kind of religion that had dominated England for a really long time.
Okay.
I think people felt really weird about it. And I think that this is why you can kind of look at Frankenstein and be like, oh, wow, people are really struggling with what advancement is like, you know? And some of Frankenstein's last words in the book are actually advice to kind of stay in a more pastoral society, you know, to not advance beyond your means. And I'm going to have you read them right now.
Seek happiness in tranquility and avoid ambition, even if it be only the apparently innocent one of distinguishing yourself in science and discoveries.
Yeah. You know, I think this was Shelley kind of communicating, like, don't just do science for science's sake.
Right.
You know, don't develop beyond your means. And it makes sense when we look at her backstory. Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin was born on August 30th, 1797 in London. Her father was William Godwin, who was a political philosopher, and he was actually one of the first modern philosophers to advocate for anarchism. Like, he believed that the government should just be done away with, and that the people should rule how they want.
This dude's rowdy as hell.
Yeah. Also very rowdy was her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, who was one of the first feminist philosophers, and wrote multiple books advocating for equal rights for women.
Oh, what?
Yeah.
What a novel concept.
Yeah, right? Her whole thing was like, hey, actually, the only reason people view women as inferior is because you don't let them go to school and don't let them, like, do anything. So maybe we're not inferior, as this book I'm writing right now proves, you know?
I don't know. Sounds kind of outrageous. Bringing all these weird concepts into the picture now.
And that's basically, like, that's why people were, like, really weirded out by her stuff.
So they were scandalized by this at the time.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, Mary Shelley seems pretty dope because her parents are both really cool writers.
Yeah.
Very cool people. Like a really good lineage so far. But Mary Wollstonecraft died of a postpartum infection. Like a, they called it like childbed fever, less than 2 weeks after giving birth to Mary. So her father would eventually remarry, but Mary Shelley and her new stepmother didn't get along very well. Just didn't really work that great.
Okay.
So you're kind of looking at Mary Shelley's life, and she's got this really troubled home life with her stepmother. Her father is drilling anarchy into her. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But this means that she struck out at a pretty young age, and she wanted to make a name for herself. And, you know, genuinely, she was super smart. She was incredibly intelligent. She started writing Frankenstein when she was 17 at the infamous, like, Dark and Stormy Night writing event. You know about that?
Yeah, wasn't it, like, Bram Stoker and who else was in that meeting?
Like, Lord Byron, probably. I don't have it written down, but, it, you know, it's that thing.
Yeah, it was a, it was one night where these, I think, four authors tried to outdo each other with the scariest possible story and just pulled themselves up during a storm and wrote.
Yeah.
And Mary Shelley's product was Frankenstein.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's how that came about. And one of the people who was at that event was her then-husband, Percy Bysshe Shelley. It's a very difficult name to say.
Percy Bysshe Shelley?
Percy Bysshe Shelley.
Okay.
Swish, swish, Bysshe. That's why I made you watch that whole Katy Perry video.
Max made me watch a music video from Katy Perry called Swish Swish, where the hook is Swish Swish Bysshe, and he said it was relevant to tonight's episode. And
Percy Shelley.
Yeah, in case you were wondering, I'm still very pissed off about that. Still in a bad mood.
So Percy Shelley was one of her dad's students originally.
Okay.
They met when Percy was 21 and Mary was 16. Percy was married, you know, so not great.
Okay. So he was already married.
Yep.
And how old was he?
He was 21.
Okay. And she was 16.
Yep.
All right.
So a little like already kind of like, well, that's not great.
Well, the age difference there, that was probably more common for the time, but
yeah, because his wife at the time was also 16. So like, I don't know.
He's got a type and it's nearly children.
Yeah.
Yikes.
You know, like, Mary was pretty advanced. This was probably something she was very well aware of what she was doing here. They quickly fell in love. They became romantically involved on Mary's dead mother's grave.
Say that again?
They quickly fell in love with one another and became romantically involved on Mary's dead mother's grave.
Wait, became romantically involved. Can you... Well, I was going to say, can you flesh that out a little bit, but that sounds like...
Yeah.
Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, that's...
They did it on her mom's grave.
Yeah, that was where Mary Shelley lost her virginity, was...
On her mother's grave.
On her mother's grave.
God, that's the single most goth thing I've ever heard in my life. Deeply strange.
Oh, you think that's the goth thing about Mary Shelley? Mary Shelley loved hanging out in graveyards.
Okay.
Like, she always felt this really strong connection with her mother. And so she would constantly be in the graveyard where her mother was, like, reading books on her mom's grave, doing her schoolwork there, just writing, having sex.
Doing it all.
Doing it all.
Living a whole damn life on her mom's grave.
And this is one of the reasons that people kind of link up Victor Frankenstein and Mary Shelley as mirrors of one another. Because Frankenstein shared this obsession. And in the book, he talks about how to examine the causes of life, we must first have recourse to death. So that was the thing that Mary Shelley was very into, was death. She probably wouldn't have been a big fan of the show. So this one's for Mary.
What up? I do think it's really cool how a lot of classic literature, you just kind of get an insight into the author pretty clearly from what they're writing. I mean, that still exists to some degree, but that's one thing that I think is kind of lost with especially genre fiction today, where like you tend to follow the tropes of a genre rather than express your personal viewpoints and perspective on things. I mean, I'm reading Moby Dick, and it's very clear that Herman Melville was like all about the sea and how cool it was to like be on the sea and how it changed your life.
He loved knots.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people think that that's really boring, but it is interesting that this guy thought that stuff was so cool and important that he wanted to express it. Sounds like Mary Shelley did a lot of the same thing. That through Victor Frankenstein, you get a little bit of insight into her perspectives, and especially about death, sounds like.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about, actually a little later, how the timing of her writing this book and also just where England was at the time met up in a really interesting way. But we'll get to that. First, I do want to talk about the fact that Mary and Percy had a kid together while Percy was married.
While he was married to his first wife.
His first 16-year-old wife, yeah.
not the current 16-year-old wife.
Yeah. So they really struggled over the next 2 years because it wasn't cool that Percy was having an affair. It wasn't cool that they had a kid. People were not happy about that. But then after 2 years, Percy's first wife committed suicide. Also seems like he really could have done a lot to not make that happen.
Oh, really?
You know? Yeah, like he probably could have just let her out of the marriage and done something there. He doesn't really seem like that stellar of a dude. But he really probably could have done something there. But after that point, they were able to get legally married and their life kind of settled down a bit. Percy Shelley himself was a vegetarian, which is interesting in a time when like that wasn't a thing you did, you know? He was also a radical proponent of nonviolence. He loved nonviolence.
Okay, is that where his vegetarianism was kind of rooted, was just nonviolence?
Yeah.
Okay.
Very against harm being done to anything. Kind of in line with Mary Shelley's dad's teachings on anarchism, where the whole thing was just, you just do right by each other and then society works, you know?
Okay.
So, unfortunately, Percy drowned in a boating accident in 1822, so 6 years after the couple got married. And there's, like, a lot of death in Mary Shelley's life. People just died a lot back then. Her mom died. Her husband died. And I think when you encounter that much death, you kind of deal with grief in some unorthodox ways. And Mary Shelley took some unorthodox paths in her grieving.
Okay.
Do you know about this?
No.
What she did with Percy's whole deal?
No. What'd she do?
So here's an excerpt from a Mental Floss article by Stacey Conrad about this.
That thing she did.
This thing she did.
Okay. Percy Bysshe Shelley drowned after his boat was caught in a storm on July 8, 1822. Shelley's body and those of his two sailing companions were found 10 days later, identifiable only by their clothing. The poet was cremated, but for some reason, his heart refused to burn. Modern-day physicians believe it may have calcified due to an earlier bout with tuberculosis. Though Percy's friend, Lee Hunt, who was there for the cremation, originally claimed the heart, it was eventually turned over to Percy's widow, Mary Shelley. Mary kept the heart in a silken shroud and is said to have carried it with her nearly everywhere for years. In 1852, a year after she died, Percy's heart was found in her desk. It was wrapped in the pages of one of his last poems, Adonais. The heart was eventually buried in the family vault with their son, Percy Florence Shelley, when he died in 1889.
That's kind of wild.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Just keeping a heart in your desk.
On multiple counts. Like, one, that his heart survived.
Yeah, crazy that it calcified, possibly. Like, tuberculosis apparently can do that to just your heart.
Yeah.
Ugh.
I didn't know about that, and I kind of forgot about it until you just said it.
That's brutal.
But, like, Katrina, my wife, works on a heart floor in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
and I'm definitely going to talk to her about that, which is very cool.
Can you imagine, like, that's how you go out, is your heart starts calcifying and stopping?
Yeah.
That's scary as fuck.
It's like bricks. You get bricked.
Ugh. Yeah, you get turned into a Nokia. Anyway, so there's this heart floating around.
Yeah, it's also kind of wild that, like, their son just had it for a while. I guess, like, he was kind of cruising around with it.
Yeah.
Because she died in, like, the 1850s, I think.
Okay.
So somehow for, like, 40 more years, they were just, like, had it.
Right.
That's weird, you know?
Well, maybe, and, you know, it's a little tip for everybody who's death positive and thinking about how they're going to go out. Maybe they just didn't have plans of what to do with that heart.
It's true.
And maybe they could have saved themselves some trouble if they had a written will or...
Draft up your will, get it notarized.
Yep.
Record it, put it somewhere public.
Like a podcast?
Yeah. but that's Mary Shelley's life. Kind of a lot of goth stuff. You would imagine she would be a big fan of The Cure.
Yeah.
Big fan of us.
She had that wavy Joy Division shirt, for sure.
But like the original version.
Yeah.
You know?
With like frills and lace.
So at this point, let's get to the good stuff and talk about Frankenstein itself. So surprisingly, the actual bit about reanimation in Frankenstein is pretty short. There's not like a ton of information given in the book about what the like reanimation event was. And it's definitely not what you would expect based on the movies where, like, Igor is running around. Igor is not in the book. There's not a lot going on there.
Where did Igor come from?
I just made him up. I don't know. He's funny.
Weird.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
And it's interesting because Shelley was writing in, like, a epistolary, like, letter format where, like, it's a frame narrative where the story of Victor Frankenstein is told by Victor Frankenstein to, like, an Arctic explorer who finds Victor Frankenstein wandering around the Arctic in a dog sled team.
Right.
It's very weird.
I love that. A similar approach was taken to Dracula. When Bram Stoker wrote it, he wrote it, like, every chapter is a journal entry
yeah.
from one of the characters. And it lends itself to almost like a documentarian sort of style that
yeah.
does make things more scary, which we will talk about on our little bonus episode next week.
Yeah. But, you know, it's kind of in direct contrast with how people at the time were writing. You know, people were writing, like, Dickensian fiction, where it was very serialized, very personal, stuff like that, very moralistic.
Right.
And Mary Shelley was trying to kind of break convention there, and Frankenstein is actually one of the first science fiction stories.
Hell yeah.
Which is pretty neat, you know? So she's kind of trying to break new ground, crossing these literary boundaries here. But because of that, because she's not a scientist, she had to make the reanimation event kind of short. But she goes a lot into Victor Frankenstein's psyche as he's doing it. So this is a long bit, but I'm going to have you read it. It's the entire reanimation scene, along with Victor Frankenstein's kind of realization of what he's created. When you read it, kind of in light of Mary Shelley kind of having a chip on her shoulder about industrialization, science, technology creating more problems in the world. It's a really interesting thing to kind of look at.
Winter, spring, and summer passed away during my labors, but I did not watch the blossom or the expanding leaves, sights which before always yielded me supreme delight, so deeply was I engrossed in my occupation. But my enthusiasm was checked by my anxiety, and I appeared rather like one doomed by slavery to toil in the mines or any other unwholesome trade than an artist occupied by his favorite employment. Every night I was oppressed by a slow fever, and I became nervous to a most painful degree. The fall of a leaf startled me, and I shunned my fellow creatures as if I had been guilty of a crime. Sometimes I grew alarmed at the wreck I perceived that I had become. The energy of my purpose alone sustained me. My labors would soon end, and I believed that exercise and amusement would then drive away incipient disease, and I promised myself both of these when my creation should be complete. It was on a dreary night of November that I beheld the accomplishment of my toils. With an anxiety that almost amounted to agony, I collected the instruments of life around me, that I might infuse a spark of being into the lifeless thing that lay at my feet. It was already 1 in the morning. The rain pattered dismally against the panes, and my candle was nearly burnt out, when, by the glimmer of the half-extinguished light, I saw the dull yellow eye of the creature open. It breathed hard, and a convulsive motion agitated its limbs. His yellow skin scarcely covered the work of muscles and arteries beneath. His hair was of a lustrous black and flowing, his teeth of a pearly whiteness. But these luxuriances only formed a more horrid contrast with his watery eyes that seemed almost of the same color as the dun-white sockets in which they were set, his shriveled complexion and straight black lips. I had worked hard for nearly 2 years for the sole purpose of infusing life into an inanimate body. For this I had deprived myself of rest and health. I had desired it with an ardor that far exceeded moderation, but now that I had finished, the beauty of the dream vanished, and breathless horror and disgust filled my heart.
Yeah, so that's the whole reanimation bit in Frankenstein. That's it. After that, he's alive. You know, there's no grand, like, lightning storm and no massive, like, it's alive! That whole
thing. Yeah, there's no lever throwing or any mechanical shit either. It's just... Yeah. Really getting at the heart of the psychology of this character.
Yeah, and like when you think about how Mary Shelley would have felt about, you know, working your whole life to build up this huge industrial empire and then realizing when you were finished, the beauty of the dream vanished and breathless horror and disgust would fill your heart, you know?
Mm.
She had a grudge.
Yeah.
Like Victor Frankenstein is not the hero of this story, you know? He's not a character you want to root for.
Yep.
And it's interesting when, like, you kind of think about how sci-fi is placed in our culture. Like, how it's a lens that we can examine ourselves at, like, an arm's length, you know?
Right.
Because at the time, England, in terms of science, was kind of at a crossroads. For a long time, science had been the realm of alchemy. It was mixing things together. It was hoping to create this fantastic new thing out of some old things. You know, kind of like throwing stuff at a wall and seeing what worked, basically.
Right.
But now science in Victorian England was getting like rigorous and regimented, and people had plans, people had procedures, but these two things were kind of like still existing at the same time. They were still around, you know? So because of that, the world was kind of moving from like a very fantastical interpretation of what could happen. Like people used to think you could make like gold out of lead and things like that.
Right.
And now people were like, well, we can't do that, but what can science actually do? And really it's you turn like poor people's labor into profit for rich people. So right. Like that kind of lead into gold thing. But it sounds really outlandish and almost fantastical to us to have this corpse reanimated with electricity and everything. But it's worth noting that Frankenstein is always categorized as science fiction and not fantasy. And since I work in a library and I care about this and I'm like very into like you know, there's like it's a horror novel, but it's also like a sci-fi horror novel. That's a distinction we want to make really clear, you know.
Okay, so this isn't just a librarian being pedantic.
No. And it's actually very interesting, because the reason Frankenstein is science fiction is because scientists in England were actually trying to do this, to like reanimate corpses with dead bodies at the time.
Like before Mary Shelley wrote this novel.
Yes. And after.
Wow.
So it was a process called galvanization.
Okay.
Which is like a thing that you do now too. Like, if you look up galvanization now, it means like to put zinc on something. Like, you would have like a galvanized nail.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So it's like a really weird thing to Google, because like people are like, oh, you mean the thing that's like normal and not like a weird thing that like 1800s crazy doctors were doing in England, you know?
So it's like how they called it consumption back in the day.
Yeah.
Instead of the disease that it actually is, it was like the old-timey word for it was galvanization.
Well, I mean, there was a guy who's the doctor who created it was Luigi Galvani.
Oh.
And so they just named it after him, and then they were like, that's crazy, it's not gonna happen, you know?
Yeah, great name.
So, kind of ironically, but also in a very cool way, in 1818, the very same year that Frankenstein was published, a chemist named Andrew Urey was doing this very same process of bringing a dead body back to life at the University of Glasgow. Which is very, very cool. It freaked a lot of people out, and there are a lot of similarities to the Frankenstein story.
Okay.
Here's an excerpt from a really good Atlas Obscura write-up of the whole event. Really remarkable stuff. Like, it's like wild that people were trying to see what worked here.
On November 4th, 1818, Scottish chemist Andrew Urey stood next to the lifeless corpse of an executed murderer, the man hanging by his neck at the gallows only minutes before. He was performing an anatomical research demonstration for a theater filled with curious students, anatomists, and doctors at the University of Glasgow. But this was no ordinary cadaver dissection. Urey held two metallic rods charged by a 270-plate voltaic battery to various nerves, and watched in delight as the body convulsed, writhed, and shuddered in a grotesque dance of death. Urey later described the event to the Glasgow Literary Society, quote, "When the one rod was applied to the slight incision in the tip of the forefinger, the fist being previously clenched, that finger extended instantly. And from the convulsive agitation of the arm, he seemed to point to the different spectators, some of whom thought he had come to life. Every muscle in his countenance was simultaneously thrown into fearful action. Rage, horror, despair, anguish, and ghastly smiles united their hideous expression in the murderer's face. At this period, several of the spectators were forced to leave the apartment from terror or sickness, and one gentleman fainted."
Yeah. I, like, didn't realize how in-depth the Victorians were into trying to revive people in, like, a very Frankenstein way.
Man, can you imagine seeing that in person? Live and in concert? Some dead dude getting shocked until he's literally pointing at you, making a weird face like...
But it's exactly like what she's describing in Frankenstein, you know?
Right.
Like, that's why it's science fiction, is because it's very, like, drawn from the headlines of what was possible with science at that time.
So maybe the distinction between fantasy and science fiction, I always think of the early term for science fiction being speculative fiction.
Yeah.
It is like taking material from real life rather than, you know, just smashing magical shit together. And
Yeah.
I see the significance of that, because this is some spooky shit, frankly.
Yeah, and it's really interesting, because this is where Frankenstein and, like, our idea of death positivity kind of come together. Because Mary Shelley was hobnobbing with a lot of academics, and she would have been aware of these experiments. And at the time in those circles, these scientists were doing these experiments because people were starting to increasingly lose faith in religion, and they were trying to figure out, like, what besides a soul made people alive. And one of the big things that they were into was electricity. They knew that there was some sort of electrical current in the body, and they were like, well, maybe that's what life is, you know?
Hmm.
And so when you are in Victorian England and people around you are dying, there's this desire to be like, well, what if this is preventable? You know, what if we can just shock people back to life? What if we can re-imbue them with electricity and therefore defeat death? Like, that's what their whole goal was here. That's what these guys who were doing these galvanization experiments, that's what this was doing.
Right. Know?
And, you know, they were doing it with murderers because they were like, well, we'll see if it works, you know? And then they were like, well, maybe if this guy's neck wasn't broken from hanging, it would have worked, you know?
Yeah, maybe. It makes sense that no one would mind if a murderer's body was experimented on and all these heinous things were done to it.
Yeah. I think we're going to do a whole episode on this in the future because it's really interesting.
Yeah.
And kind of the politics of that. But you can see why people would believe that this was, like, legitimately how people were being brought back to life, you know? Have you ever seen those videos? I hate them. But, like, where a fish is skinned or something, and then someone, like, rubs salt onto it, and it starts, like, flopping around.
No. Ugh.
They are horrible.
Okay.
So
I shouldn't look it up.
You should. You should, actually. It's really...
I was going to say I'm going to.
Freak you the fuck out. You should look at one right now. Just search, like, fish salt rub. Oh, I found it. Mmm.
Show it to me. Show it to me. I want to see it. I want to be spooked.
I don't like it.
It doesn't have a head.
It's cut in half.
It's half of a fish with no head. When does it stop?
So it just keeps going.
Oh my god, that was like one third of the video.
Yeah. So, like, when we look at videos like this today, what's going on in those videos where people rub, like, a salt brine onto frog legs or a fish? The salt creates, like, connection points in the nerves of the fish, and it creates these little electrical bursts. And what that does is that makes the muscles twitch and contract.
Hmm.
And so it starts jerking around like it's trying to get away, like it's moving, you know? So that's why, like, a skinned fish looks like it's alive, and why frog legs dance if you sprinkle salt on them.
Ugh.
But you can imagine how, like, if you've never seen this before because you've never had electricity, and someone has a guy's body in, like, an operating room and then puts electricity in it, and then he starts, like, jerking around and pointing his finger in a convulsing way like that, you would be freaked out.
Right.
And you would also think, this dead person is alive again.
Right. Yeah.
And in some way, we've done it. We've defeated death.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And it's this kind of weird intersection of Mary Shelley is trying to grapple with this. And being a romantic is really into this idea of, like, the natural cycle of things and natural life and the natural way that things were supposed to go. But these scientists are afraid of death. They are trying to break death. They're trying to cheat death.
Right.
Kind of like a lot of what the transhumanists we've talked about are trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're trying to subvert death and get around it. They were trying to get around death in a medical, technological way. And she was looking at that and being like, I don't like that. That's horrible.
Right.
And then wrote one of the most famous horror stories of all time about that. You know, I think it's really interesting to kind of consider how this work, Frankenstein, is directly influenced by ideas that we're still kind of dealing with today, like transhumanism and trying to subvert death in medical ways, you know, extending the human lifespan. because religion had been removed from this place in English life, technology was the new savior, the new god, you know?
Right.
And Victor Frankenstein is a guy who is directly subverting death by making technology his god, and it does not go well for him.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, that's something I really do want to cover more in a future episode, but I think we're gonna end it there. So we do have a lot of stuff to dig into in the future, and we've got some fun stuff already planned for October.
Yes.
So I think if we end this here, I hope people won't be too upset.
Yeah, it is a good natural ending point, though. I mean, one of the most famous, successful horror stories of all time has its roots in a way, death positivity.
Yeah. Mary Shelley is writing this as a way that it's like, no, death is normal and it's part of the natural world. And you should just let it happen.
Right.
You know, don't fuck with it.
Yeah. And you, listening to this podcast, you thought we were getting off track and not covering death positive stuff. Well, guess what? We're back in the shit.
Frankenstein, Mary Shelley, death positive.
That's right.
Homegirl.
Woo! Thank you so much, Max. This was a wonderful Halloween treat.
Spooky. Not a trick.
Not a trick. It was just a treat. Thank you guys for listening to this podcast. What do you think about Frankenstein and about technology and the impact that it has on defeating death, or allegedly defeating death? All these things. Talking about some big concepts. Have you read Frankenstein? Talk to us about it. We love hearing from y'all. You can message us on Twitter or Instagram at PreDeadBoys. Email us predeadboys@gmail.com. And if you search PreDeadBoys podcast on Facebook, you can find our Facebook group and we can chat about it there. What other spooky stuff do you like? We want to talk about it. It's spooky season. We're in the mood for spooks. Woo! If you want to support what we do on this podcast, there's a few ways you can do that. Number one, tell a friend about this podcast. It's all word of mouth. We don't advertise. Number two, you can tip us a few bucks at ko-fi.com/predeadboys. For example, we got a donation from Fizz Cockman.
Yes.
Yeah, this is a friend of ours. We know who this is. I had to look them up and see, like, the PayPal. And I was like, oh, okay.
I was like, oh, it's Ryan.
Yeah, okay, it's Peacock. Fizz Cockman says, I love your guys' podcast. I tell everyone about it. And listening to this reminds me of those sweet times in SODAC. Thanks for creating this awesome podcast. Yeah, it's our friend Ryan.
Total sweetheart.
We went to South Dakota with him, and he's a very sweet dude.
Yeah.
And he was sweet before giving us money.
Yeah, yeah. He's always been a big sweetheart.
Giving us money is an extra treat on top of a sweet treat. Very fitting for spooky season. Thank you so much, Ryan. You can also leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, and we will read it on this here episode. For example, we got a 5-star review.
Aww.
It's from Morbid in Minneapolis.
I just got my Timberwolves jersey.
He did. He got that
Robert Covington
bootleg
yeah,
fucking jersey. It looks cool as fuck. Anyway, Morbid in Minneapolis says, fascinating, informative, and weird. 5 stars. You guys have turned me into the kind of person who hangs out in cemeteries before work and talks to my husband about Viking funerals and shrunken heads. Thanks for making the world a little brighter by making it a little darker.
Aww.
And thank you very much. Morbid in Minneapolis, you would find some good company in Mary Shelley, kicking it in graveyards.
Yeah. Please talk to me about the Minnesota Timberwolves. I'm very excited. Basketball's about to start. Join our Facebook group and talk to me about basketball.
Yes. Rest in Power Prince, legend of Minneapolis, best musician of all time. Best musician of all time?
I'm gonna stand by it.
That's a bold take. Anyway, thank you so much. Our intro and outro music is A Song About Time by Brathurst. Check them out at brathurst.bandcamp.com. And that's not gonna do it for us. We have a very important announcement to make here. Next month, we are going to launch a Patreon. Now, if you don't know, Max just spit LaCroix hibiscus all over this room.
Hibiscus?
No, he didn't. But we are going to launch a Patreon. If you don't know, Patreon is basically this platform where if you give money to a creator every month, you help support what they do and the work that they put forth in creating things. And you typically get a little bit of a bonus as a reward. So we're going to have more information about that next week.
Yep.
When we do a special bonus episode.
Yep.
And the idea is that these bonus episodes, you know, next week is going to be an example of the sort of thing that you can come to expect from our bonus episodes on Patreon. We're going to have more information in that episode, just detailing all that stuff. But yeah, Max and I love doing this podcast. It's a lot of work, but it is totally worth it. And we would like to give people the opportunity to help us just compensate ourselves for the work that we're putting into this.
And also, like, join up with us, you know?
Yeah. Already, you know, this podcast wouldn't exist without people's support and people listening to it and saying nice things and sharing it with their friends. So we want to give an opportunity to kind of give back to the people who are especially able to just kick us a few bucks and help us do what we do. That would be awesome. And yeah, we'll have more information about all that stuff next week. But in the meantime, thank you for getting us to the point where we can bother having a Patreon.
Yeah, where it's not just disappointing.
Yeah, and to be clear, this podcast is always going to be free.
Always.
You are never going to pay for once every 2 weeks the well-researched, very entertaining and fun podcast that we put out.
Yep.
That's not changing at all. We're just going to provide some extra goodies for people who want to get in on that.
Yep, absolutely.
Now that's going to do it for us. That's it.
That's all for real this time?
Yeah, for real this time.
Unless we come back from the dead.
Happy spooky season, everyone. We got more good stuff for you for the rest of the month. Thanks for listening. Max and Doreen here reminding you, you're going to rap.
Bye.
Expected Bish to be spelled. That's how right? we should standardize. So B-Y-S-S-H-E. We should standardize that when somebody says ya bish.
Bish.
Like if somebody calls somebody else a bish, they have to spell it that way.
B-Y-S-S.
Ya bish. I'm tweeting that today.